This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm David Bianculli, editor of the website TV Worth Watching, in for Terry Gross. What makes the brains of people with autism spectrum disorder different from the brains of neurotypical people? That's one of the questions our guest, neuroscientist Alvaro Pasqual-Leone, is trying to answer with his research stimulating parts of the brain with electromagnetic fields to alter targeted parts of the brain's circuitry. It's a procedure known as transcranial magnetic stimulation, or TMS. TMS already is being used to treat certain conditions, including depression. But with autism, it's in the experimental stage. One of the participants in Dr. Pasqual-Leone's study is John Elder Robison, who's also joining us. Robison was diagnosed with Asperger's syndrome and is now considered to have autism spectrum disorder. He received weekly TMS treatments for 6 months. And both he and the research team were surprised by the emotional awakening he experienced. Robison's new memoir, Switched On, is about his TMS treatments. Robison wrote an earlier memoir about having autism called Look Me in the Eye. He used to engineer and design effects for rock shows. Then he started a company that sells, services, and restores late model European vehicles. He's also now the Neurodiversity Scholar in Residence at the College of William and Mary and serves on the federal government's Interagency Autism Coordinating Committee. Dr. Pasqual-Leone is a professor of neurology at Harvard Medical School and director of the Center for Non-Invasive Brain Stimulation at Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center, which is one of Harvard's teaching hospitals. He wrote the introduction to Robison's book. They spoke with Terry last Thursday.
Dr. Alvaro Pasqual-Leone, John Elder Robison, welcome to both of you to Fresh Air. Doctor, I want to start with you. What is transcranial magnetic stimulation?
So transcranial magnetic stimulation is a method, a tool, that allows us to introduce a small amount of current into specific parts of the brain without having to use surgery to do so. In other words, non-invasively through the skin and the skull. We use a magnetic field to pass through the skin and the skull painlessly and introduce current in the brain. The reason to do that is because the brain ultimately uses current to do its work, and by introducing current in it, we can probe the function of certain parts of the brain. We can even modify how different parts of the brain work.
So what's the theory behind how you're using it with people with autism, stroke, depression, epilepsy, Parkinson's disease?
There are two very different goals in those applications. The first set of goals is to understand better how the brain works in those conditions in patients that have those diseases. Part of the reason to understand it better is to develop new ways to diagnose the conditions earlier. Another reason to understand it is to be able to develop new treatments. In addition to those diagnostic applications, there are also therapeutic applications. It turns out that by applying transcranial magnetic stimulation to different parts of the brain repeatedly, day after day after day, we can modify the brain activity in those areas, and that can translate into a benefit for patients with different disorders. Those type of therapeutic applications are now, for example, approved for treatment of patients with medication refractory depression, the forms of depression that don't respond to treatment. In the case of autism, we are earlier in those applications, and it's premature to use TMS for therapy, but it's a very powerful tool to try to understand better how the brain of people with autism is different from the brain of people that don't have autism.
So what do the conditions that we mentioned, autism, stroke, depression, epilepsy, Parkinson's, what do they have in common that make them things that you think might be treatable through TMS?
That's a great question, and perhaps it requires my explaining a little bit how we think of the brain in relationship to these disorders. One can think of any one disorder, depression or autism or Parkinson's, as a label that is applied to people that have certain symptoms. Take, for example, Parkinson's. It's hard to get going. It's hard to move fast enough. It's hard to think thoughts. There is tremor and involuntary movements. Each one of those symptoms maps onto a given circuit of the brain. The reason why that circuit of the brain is not functioning properly in the case of Parkinson's has to do with a deficit of a certain chemical in the brain. But the point is that if we can identify the circuit that causes the symptoms, we can target that circuit and make it function better with brain stimulation. So in the sense, it's not a treatment for the disorder, for the ultimate cause of the disorder, but it's an intervention that improves how the patient is able to function. It's a more symptomatic treatment rather than a causal treatment.
So you're basically trying to activate certain pathways in the brain that aren't functioning like they should.
Yeah, you're trying to modify the activity. Sometimes it's activating, sometimes it's actually deactivating.
Mm-hmm.
So it turns out that sometimes a certain pathway in the brain is too active, and it is that excess of activity that causes the symptoms.
John, why were you willing to participate in this study, and what were your hopes?
When I learned about this study from one of Alvaro's researchers, I was just immediately captivated by the idea of TMS. I had never heard of TMS before, but I had worked with the underlying electronic technology in my career as an engineer, and I just thought, how cool is that to apply the technologies I used in rock and roll sound systems to change the brain, and at the same time, the goal of the study to maybe improve emotional insight, as Alvaro said, that spoke to the heart of something that I felt had disabled me all my life. So I was fascinated and captivated by it.
John, one of the most profound things that happened to you as a result of the electric stimulation to your brain was your experience of music. Now, you used to be an engineer working at rock concerts, designing sound systems and flashy things for bands like Kiss. And then you became an auto engineer, a car engineer, and have your own shop. So music has really been a part of your life. But after these treatments, you started experiencing music differently. Can you talk about the before and after experience of music?
There were two things that were really profound for me. First, when I worked as an engineer in music, I used to hear every little detail of the performance. You know, the guy would hit a note on the bass guitar, and I would hear the buzzing of the snares on the bottom of the drum, or the singer would walk across the stage, and I would hear the swishing as he dragged the cable behind him. And to me, those were all clues that things were working or not working. And after I stopped working in music, that kind of rich detail faded away. And when I came out of the lab after one stimulation and I turned on the stereo in my car, just the majesty of it and the brilliance and clarity, it was so real and so alive, it made me cry all the way home. And I wrote Alvaro and I told him that when I got home. And the thing is, it wasn't that they created something new. They reactivated something that was like so central to my life, and it had faded away. And it was like magic.
My impression from your book is that you also experienced an emotional quality to the music that you hadn't experienced before.
That took a little while longer for it to sink in for me, but that's absolutely right. What I first heard was all of the technical detail, like I said to you. I never really, in producing music, heard what the songs were about. What I heard were all the details that I had to hear to do a good job of delivering that sound to the audience. But somehow, after the stimulation, I heard what the songs meant. You know, that they were love stories or sad stories or stories of hope. And I hadn't heard that part of the message before, as much music as I had done.
Can I raise an issue that we found interesting,
please,
Terry?
Please.
So, you know, when you apply TMS, you hold a coil, it's like a plastic covered spoon, of you know, like a paddle, over the person's head. And the person doesn't really know exactly what part of the brain you're targeting. They feel a tap, they hear a clicking, but we're aiming it for specific parts of the brain. And we use the fact that the subject doesn't know exactly what part of the brain we're targeting as a way to control the specificity of the effects, targeting different areas as controls, as I was describing. So the experience that John is describing happened when targeting one very specific part of the brain in this frontal area that I was describing. It did not happen when we targeted other areas. So it wasn't every time that he experienced TMS that he had this experience, but only when targeting a given area, an area that we had hypothesized would lead to an increase in emotional connectiveness if we were able to suppress it appropriately, because we had a hypothesis that activity in that area is excessive in the case of autism, and it's excessively suppressing the normal circuitry that allows people without autism to relate to emotions appropriately.
Oh, so that's really interesting. I would have thought you were activating that circuitry, but you're actually suppressing it.
Yep.
And explain again why, for someone with autism, you're suppressing that particular circuitry as opposed to activating it. What's the theory behind that?
So we had a hypothesis. It is just, you know, it was an experiment to see whether this is true or not. The fact is that individuals in the spectrum of autism spectrum disorders have difficulties understanding, reading emotions, and that can be shown and tested in a variety of different ways. But for example, you present faces expressing different emotions, and individuals with autism don't recognize the emotion as readily, or not at all in some instances. And one possibility is that the circuits of the brain that allow those without autism to recognize emotions, that those circuits are not there or are faulty or are damaged in some form. But another possibility is that circuits of the brain that control those circuits, that those are excessively good at controlling, that there is too much of a suppression of that circuit. The reason why we need those circuits is that in some circumstances we need to suppress our own emotions to be able to do things that make us cringe or that are painful. Think of a physician when treating a patient. We have to do things to the patient, like draw blood, where we know it may cause some discomfort or some pain. And in order to do that, we need to control our emotional response to that. Well, if you have an excessive control of the emotional responses, you may end up being disabled by a lack of emotional resonance. And that was the hypothesis we had. That's why we were doing the experiments that John was participating in.
John, in talking about how this electronic stimulation of your brain caused you to experience music in a more emotional way, what about in the rest of your life? Did you experience more emotion in your interactions with people? My impression from your book is your empathy increased, your ability to read other people's emotions increased.
That's right. I was always possessed of strong emotions. What I wasn't possessed of was reaction to situations with other people. And indeed, after another stimulation, when I could look in your eyes and like feel like I was just reading your thoughts, which was really weird and powerful for me, because that had never, ever happened in my life, where just looking at somebody and having her tell me about putting a water pump on her car, but I would look at her and I would see that she was, you know, worried and frightened and anxious, and I thought, you know, excuse me, I got to go outside and gather myself for a second, because I was almost reduced to tears by an ordinary conversation of commerce. And I think that looking back on that time, I now see that having this unregulated ability to read emotion was actually, for me, perhaps more disabling than being oblivious to the emotion, because when I was oblivious, I could just listen to her tell me about the water pump leak, and I didn't even notice if she was scared or anxious.
Now, there was a very unusual outcome to this as well, which is that your second wife suffered from clinical depression, and you never really understood the sadness of that depression. And she was very helpful to you in helping you read other people's emotions. Once you started to be able to read other people's emotions, your relationship to your wife shifted, including the fact that you were able to read her sadness. And experiencing her sadness sounds like it was just overwhelming for you.
You're right, but it was much more than that. When I volunteered for this study, I had, I guess, this fantasy in my mind. I thought there must be all these messages of beauty and sweetness and light that I was missing, and if only I could get them, things would be wonderful for me. And when I was able to see emotion, it wasn't just in my marriage. It was in the people all around me, and I saw that the world was filled with angst and fear and worry. But you know, the really hardest thing was seeing people that I had thought had been my friends and realizing that they were laughing at me, and I thought we were all laughing together at jokes and I was the joke. And that was really, really hard. And it even affected my memories. I remembered things that I used to think were funny. And in this new illumination, I was like the fool. You know, it was really painful. And as much hope as I had for that, I can't remember a single thing that turned beautiful and sweet in my memory, but there's a lot of stuff that turned bad and sad.
What lasting effect have these experiments had on you? What do you experience now when you hear music? What do you feel when someone is telling you about their sadness?
I feel it now, and what's really funny is I can't go to movies anymore. I can't watch TV. 10 years ago, I could have sat through the Texas Chainsaw Massacre, eating popcorn and stuff, and wouldn't have cared. Now, it's really upsetting and really stressful to me just to watch the evening news. I can't do it. I used to make jokes about people who would read a news story about something bad that happened on the other side of the world, and they'd be, you know, all crying and wailing about it, and they must be just making a play for attention. But you know, that happens to me now. I could pick up the newspaper and I could read a story and it would make me feel like I was going to start crying and I couldn't read it aloud.
You know, it makes me wonder, because this kind of empathy is so new to you, you didn't grow up developing the kind of coping skills to deal with all the sadness and pain and anxiety in the world.
It's like I lost a protective shield. All these memories that hurt me because I was like the butt of a joke or something, I now realize that I just kind of went through life and people maybe said mean things about me, but I never knew, so it didn't hurt. And now, stuff like that, it really hurts a lot. But at the same time, I know that my ability to serve, like on these autism committees, I think that's the greatest thing I've ever done in my life. And I'm really proud I can do that, you know, and I think that this made it possible. And so there's pain that I felt from having these emotions come on. But you know, I'm just so proud that I could do this thing, you know, that's important to young people and other people with autism and differences. I'm so proud that I can go out and connect with people and do something that really helps people. And I feel like this was a key part of making that possible.
Now, obviously, I'm hearing a lot of emotion in your voice right now.
Well, it makes me sad to think of the hurt, you know, the mm-hmm. hurt in my life, but I have that pride, too.
No, I understand that. I'm wondering, if I spoke to you 10 years ago, before you had this experimental magnetic stimulation of your brain, Would you
10 years ago, Terry, I wouldn't even have had a conversation like this with you. I couldn't have done it. And if we went back 30 years ago, I wouldn't even have talked to you. I'd have started taking apart your radio studio.
Because you're an engineer. But do you remember in your past, before getting these experimental magnetic stimulations of your brain, do you remember ever tearing up while reflecting on your own experience?
No, things like that never happened to me before TMS. After all this seeing of emotion, though, one thing that I've come away with is the knowledge that I wanted all my life to be able to read these emotions. But, of course, reading emotions just makes me like everyone else. And I think a debt that I could never repay Alvaro and those scientists is that they showed me that my geeky ability to see into machines and see into things, that's my true gift in life, too, that nobody else can do that.
Right.
Thanks to the way that John has described it, in a very simplistic sort of image, as learning to drive a car, you apply the right amount of acceleration. But if your car was delivered to you with a handbrake on and you never knew that, then you would think, well, it doesn't drive quite as fast, but so be it. If you now all of a sudden are relieved of that handbrake, you're faced with a completely different challenge as to how to apply your foot onto the gas pedal, because all of a sudden it's sort of flying off from you. So I think part of the challenges that John is experiencing in coping with emotions may have to do with the fact that this handbrake, as it were, this excessively controlled, suppressed circuitry has been relieved of that excessive suppression by the moment of insight and experience that he had. And we need to learn what the implications of that is and how to appropriately modify activity in those areas if we want to help people without the exposure to potentially negative consequences.
I want to thank you both so much for talking with us. John Elder Robison, Dr. Alvar Pasqualeoni, thank you so much.
Well, thank you for having us with you.
John Robison and Dr. Alvaro Pasqualeoni spoke with Terry last Thursday. Robison is the author of the new book, Switched On, A Memoir of Brain Change and Emotional Awakening. Dr. Pasqualeoni is a professor of neurology at Harvard Medical School and principal researcher in the TMS study in which Robison participated. Our book critic, Maureen Corrigan, has a review of two new historical suspense novels that take us deep into the past and may leave readers with some nightmares that linger into the present.
I'm about to rave about two audacious works of historical suspense fiction. I say audacious because you have to have some nerve to tackle the subject of whaling after Melville, or to structure your story around a painting after so many other novelists, most recently Tracy Chevalier and Donna Tartt, have kickstarted their own tales with the same device. But not to worry. The only thing tired about these novels will be you, dear reader, because you really will want to stay up all night to finish them. The North Water, a debut novel by Ian McGuire, is an adventure tale about survival at the frozen top of the world. It opens in 1859 when a young man named Patrick Sumner signs on as ship's doctor to a whaler named the Volunteer. Sumner, who served with the British Army in India, is a survivor of the bloody siege of Delhi. His service, which has left him with a disability and a hidden opium addiction, earned Sumner some respect and distance from the hard-living crew. Here's a scene where he's alone in his cabin, taking inventory of the ship's medicine chest. Sumner's cabin has the dimensions of an infant's mausoleum and smells already, before the voyage has even begun, sour and faintly fecal. He peers skeptically into the medicine chest and begins to make his shopping list. Hartshorn, he writes, Glauber's salt, spirit of squills. Half the things in there he has never heard of. Was the previous surgeon some kind of druid? Laudanum, absinthe, opium pills, mercury. Will there be much gonorrhea amongst a whaling crew, he wonders? Possibly not, since whores in the Arctic Circle are likely to be thin on the ground. Judging by the amount of Epsom salts and castor oil already in the chest, however, constipation will be a sizable problem. Once the volunteer sets sail, Sumner realizes his assumption that, as ship's doctor, he'll enjoy plenty of downtime to read his beloved Homer is naive. As soon as the first seal pack is sighted, Sumner is shoved out on the ice with the rest of the crew to shoot and club seals and to try not to fall into the black waters that swirl around the moving ice floes. It's the poetic precision of Maguire's harsh vision of the past that makes his novel such a standout. I suggested that initial Melville comparison because of Maguire's detailed accounts of whaling, of course. But he's more in line with Gothic writers like Mary Shelley and Poe, who imagined the blank wastes of the Arctic as a kind of frozen hell. Like Sumner, we readers are enticed on board the Volunteer and then find ourselves swept along on what turns out to be a voyage of the damned. On first impression, the last painting of Sarah DeVos may strike readers as more restrained, an indoor still life compared to the North Water's extreme outdoor landscape. That would be a mistaken first impression. Dominic Smith's novel about the eerie powers of art and the long reach of the past is every bit as harrowing in its own subtle way as its more physical counterpart. Smith masterfully juggles three places and time periods throughout this novel: Amsterdam during the golden age of Dutch painting, New York City during one of its own golden ages in the 1950s, and at novel's end, Sydney, Australia at the dawn of the 21st century. A fictional 17th century painting called At the Edge of a Wood connects all the whirling stories of deceit and female ambition and suppression here. It's a winter scene of a girl standing by a tree watching skaters on a frozen river below. For the Dutch artist Sarah DeVos, who's based on a composite of actual women artists of the 17th century, the painting dramatizes the separation from life of her young daughter, who died in the plague. For a female art student surveying the work in the 1950s, it's a moment of suspension, a girl trapped by the eternity of dusk. The haunting painting tempts that art student into a crime and, unwittingly, leaves her vulnerable to a betrayal every bit as brutal as the scenes of slaughter in the North Water. Both novels are absolutely transporting, even if the moments in the past they take us to are sometimes difficult to witness.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. She reviewed The North Water by Ian Maguire and The Last Painting of Sarah DeVos by Dominic Smith. It's hard to remember, when you're surrounded by tall buildings or suburban sprawl, that there still is wilderness in America. Perhaps the best example is the Greater Yellowstone Ecosystem, one of the last unspoiled temperate ecosystems on Earth. It encompasses over 22 million acres and includes Yellowstone National Park, Grand Teton National Park, and other private and public lands. Animals that once were threatened, such as grizzly bears and bison, now thrive there. And millions of people visit each year. The needs of the wild animals and the needs and safety of the visitors often are in conflict. And that's just one of the many conflicts in the Yellowstone ecosystem. The entire May issue of National Geographic is devoted to Yellowstone and the battle for the American West. The issue commemorates the centennial of the National Park Service. The text was written by our next guest, David Quammen, who spoke with Terry last Monday.
David Quammen, welcome to Fresh Air. In your article, there are many times you're not referring to Yellowstone National Park. You're referring to the Yellowstone ecosystem. So what is the larger ecosystem that the park is a part of?
That's right. We call it the Greater Yellowstone Ecosystem. It is this huge body of mostly wild landscape. It amounts to about 22 million acres, and it includes Yellowstone National Park, Grand Teton National Park, portions of 5 national forests, several wildlife refuges, including the National Elk Refuge, Bureau of Land Management land, that's federal land, private land, some big private ranches, a portion of the Wind River Indian Reservation, all of those things, contiguous and mostly wild landscape in the area of Yellowstone Park. It's a huge amoeba within which Yellowstone Park is a rectangle that constitutes about a tenth of the total area.
And you're calling it an ecosystem, so I imagine you see this as a very interdependent set of places.
Oh, absolutely. It has been realized in recent decades that Yellowstone Park is not an island. It's part of this larger system, this larger body of wild landscape, and it needs the rest of this wild landscape just as the rest of the wild landscape needs it. There are animals that are moving across boundaries. The great elk migrations, for instance, move in and out of Yellowstone National Park seasonally. Pronghorn move in and out of Grand Teton National Park. Grizzly bears move across the boundaries. All of these factors are interconnected. All of these species and processes are interconnected in this great ecosystem, within which live, for instance, all the original big predator species, all the original great carnivores, the grizzly bear, the black bear, the wolf, the mountain lion, the coyote. They're all there interacting with their prey species, interacting with the landscape. It's part of what makes the Greater Yellowstone Ecosystem so special.
There's a lot of environmental debates that are kind of crystallized around Yellowstone National Park. And one of those debates has to do with how do you handle the needs of the wild animals and the needs of the people who are visiting the park? The people coming to the park don't want to be mauled. At the same time, it's part of the goal of the park to have wild grizzlies there. Mm-hmm. So can you kind of crystallize that debate for us, or that conflict between having a park that's great for the animals and having a park that's great for the humans who visit the park?
Well, it is a complicated situation. It's paradoxical because we're taking a place and we're saying we want this place to continue to be wild, but in order for it to seem wild, to appear wild, to give people the experience of what the wild in the Northern Rockies is, we've got to do some tinkering. We've got to do some management. We have to have some rules and some boundaries. And that goes back to the beginning, the founding of Yellowstone National Park back in 1872. It was a great tourist destination for people who wanted to see geysers and canyons. And then gradually we realized that part of the importance of this place was as a great wildlife refuge. So how do you manage the wildlife in a way that people can enjoy them, people can appreciate seeing them, people can feel safe visiting this place? And yet the wildlife can be, to some degree, in some sense, wild. It's very tricky. It's tricky for the bison. It's tricky for grizzly bear. It's tricky for a number of different species.
Well, let's look at grizzly bears. I mean, they're really an object of fascination, I think, for most people. What makes grizzly bears extraordinary?
Well, they are the largest, most ferocious, most magnificent carnivore in North America. They lived throughout the western U.S. 100 years ago and before, and now because they are so ferocious and so uncompromising and needy in terms of privacy and space and prey, they have disappeared throughout the American West and exist only in a very few places. Glacier National Park, there's a population of grizzly bear up on the Montana-Canadian border. A few places in the northern Pacific Northwest, there are a few grizzlies. And in Yellowstone, there is this big population of grizzlies because there is so much habitat. There is so much space. They were nearly eradicated from Yellowstone back in the late 60s, early 70s. The population, for reasons I could explain, went down to about 140 or fewer grizzly bears. They were put on the endangered species list as threatened in 1975, and gradually the population has been brought back. So now there are more than 700 in the ecosystem.
There was a period where the bears were feeding on garbage dumps with, like, human garbage, you know, leftovers from the campfire, from dinner. And that became like the steady diet of a lot of grizzly bears.
That's
and
right.
It also made them into a big tourist attraction because you could go to the dump and see the bears. But that didn't work out well for anybody. Would you tell that story?
Yes. And that goes back to the early 20th century. There was a very important superintendent of Yellowstone, a man who was involved in the founding of the National Park Service itself, Horace Albright. And he became superintendent, which is the boss of Yellowstone Park, in 1919, from 1919 to 1929. Later, he was director of the Park Service itself. But during that period, Albright embraced the idea that in order for the national parks, and Yellowstone in particular, to have support from the American people and from politicians, there needed to be wildlife as spectacle. And for wildlife to be available as spectacle, Horace Albright said, wildlife needs to be abundant and tame. And so he sanctioned the idea that grizzly bears would be fed handouts from cars and would be allowed to eat garbage from the various hotels within Yellowstone National Park. So there were these dumps near the big hotels in Yellowstone National Park. And the food garbage each day was put out there on these dumps, and the grizzly bears were allowed, invited, essentially, to come and feed at the dumps. At a certain point, they decided this was great. This was the bear show. And they put up stands like bleachers around these natural amphitheaters at the dump site. So people would go out in the 1940s, the 1950s, even in the 1960s. You might finish your dinner at one of the hotels in Yellowstone, and then you'd say, let's go look at the bear show. And you would go out to the dump, and you'd sit in bleachers, and you would watch 12, 15, 18 grizzly bears, adult, dangerous, male, females with cubs, grizzly bears, feeding on garbage. Eventually, in the 1960s, ideas changed, and it was decided that these dumps should be closed and that it was unseemly, it was unnatural, it was not right for people to watch grizzly bears eating garbage. So the dumps should be closed. They were closed in the late 60s and early 70s, and then the grizzly bears were desperate for a few years, searching for substitutes for all this high-calorie human garbage that they had been eating.
They were used to things like hamburgers and stuff, like leftover hamburgers.
Yeah. Hamburger,
and now they had a forage and they didn't really know how.
That's right. Now grizzlies are omnivores.
Or hunt, I guess. Forage and hunt, right.
Forage and hunt. They're hunter-gatherers. They're omnivores. They eat a lot of vegetable, plant foods. They eat various kinds of insects. They eat earthworms. They eat tubers of wildflowers. They eat fish when they can get fish. And they eat meat when they can get meat. They eat virtually everything. Very diverse diets, but they scramble to get the calories that they need from a limited number of high-caloric foods. And garbage had been one of those until the early 70s, and suddenly it was gone. And this was a crisis for the grizzly bear population in the Yellowstone ecosystem.
Let's talk about the elk. There's a problem that the National Park Service has in dealing with the elk. The elk go through migrations, but part of their migratory patterns are blocked. What's blocking them?
Private land development threatens to block more and more of their migrations. Elk don't respect linear boundaries drawn on a map. The elk of Yellowstone National Park spend their summers in the high country of Yellowstone, feeding on the high grasses that remain green through the summer. But in the winter, those high places become brutally cold. And so the elk move down. They move down to what we call winter range. They move down off the Yellowstone Plateau, where Yellowstone Park is, to lower elevations in the surrounding lands, onto national forests, and in some cases, onto large private ranches. They have to go down to find places where they can survive and eat during the hard months of the Montana, Wyoming, Idaho winter. Now, there are biologists that I talked to in the course of researching this issue who told me, you know, there are a lot of problems facing the Yellowstone ecosystem, but the one most crucial problem, if you're going to point to one, is private lands development. It's not hunting. It's not even climate change, which is an issue. These are all tangled together. But private lands development around the periphery of the parks, Grand Teton and Yellowstone, is a crucial issue, because if those private lands are transformed from open pastures, meadow, forest land, to suburbs, to little ranchettes, to shopping malls, to roads, to Starbucks, if those places are all settled for the benefit of humans, then the elk are not going to be able to migrate in and out of Yellowstone Park anymore. And if the elk can't migrate into the park, then that creates problems for the wolves, for the grizzlies, for a lot of other creatures. These things all fit together. The elk are the most abundant large herbivores in the Yellowstone ecosystem. There are thousands and thousands of them. They migrate in and out. And those migration routes need to stay open.
So one of the paradoxes here is that people who love the wildlife and the natural beauty of Yellowstone and want to live really close to it also risk being part of the problem in terms of interrupting the migratory routes for the elk.
That's absolutely right. There are ways in which Yellowstone is in danger of being loved to death. Essentially two ways. One of them is that visitorship is going up. 4 million visits to Yellowstone National Park last year. And most of those people come and bring their private automobiles. That's becoming a problem. But even more of a problem is the question of private lands development. People visiting the West, visiting Wyoming, Montana, coming to Yellowstone saying, boy, I like this. I'm going to buy a second home here. Or I'm going to retire here. And wanting a piece of this wild landscape. So people come, and it's very understandable, but it has corrosive implications. There's one very crotchety and wonderful and knowledgeable mountain backcountry guide named Wes Livingston out of Cody, Wyoming. And Wes told me that, well, when he runs into these well-meaning conservationists, environmentalists, wealthy people who have moved to this area, and they tell him all of their conservation concerns. Wes says, well, I tell them, if you really want to do something to help wildlife, burn your house down and go back to California.
Let's talk a little bit about just like the geography of Yellowstone. I mean, about a third of it sits over an active volcano. So that's not going to erupt anytime in the immediate future, is it?
We hope not. It has exploded in three huge explosions over the last 2.1 million years, creating these big basins that they call the calderas. One of them is known as the Yellowstone Caldera. It occupies a good portion of the central part of Yellowstone National Park. It is still an active, they call it a supervolcano. It's this hot spot underneath the continental plate, burning its way through the continental plate. To understand why Yellowstone is wild, why it's remote, why it's high, why it's cold, why it was never settled in the early days of European settlement in the West, to understand all that, you have to understand the volcanic forces and sources of heat underneath it. And it's this supervolcano, this hotspot, that is pushing magma, molten and semi-molten rock and heat upward, creating the Yellowstone Plateau.
Now, America's most famous geyser, Old Faithful, is a result of this volcano, right?
It is. There are a number of geysers, a huge number, I think 10,000 hydrothermal features of various different sorts, of which Old Faithful is the most famous, the iconic image of Yellowstone. And that's because this volcanic hotspot is heating the waters underneath, and those waters are pushing upward in the form of steam and pressurized water, and they break through cracks in the surface of Yellowstone, in the geyser basins and certain other parts of Yellowstone. And some of them erupt as geysers regularly. Some of them erupt irregularly. So when the early explorers, the early white European explorers came to Yellowstone, the first thing that caught their attention was not the wildlife. It was the Grand Canyon of the Yellowstone River and all of these geysers, all of these springs full of colorful, bubbling, liquid mud, a good place to hang out if you were very cold in the middle of the winter. But it had a reputation as being spooky. But it was the geysers, the thermal features, and the canyon that caused Yellowstone National Park to be created back in 1872. It wasn't even thought of as a wildlife refuge in those days.
What was it thought of as? Just as a place to see weird volcanic effects?
Yeah, it was thought of as a great tourist attraction. Yellowstone, as I say, is a big idea that has gotten bigger, a good idea that's gotten better. But it's, I think, important to understand the history of Yellowstone, that it wasn't always this great idea. It began as a very commercial idea. The original impetus for creating the national park came largely from minions of the Northern Pacific Railroad who wanted to sell train tickets and hotel rooms to tourists who fancied coming out to see these canyons and geysers. With Yellowstone, it was decided that this should remain a public place so that people could come, albeit you would be paying the Northern Pacific Railroad to bring you out and you would be paying a hotel operator to let you stay there, but people could come out and essentially for free they could see America's greatest, most majestic landscapes in the West. And so it was decided that this would be a public park for the benefit and enjoyment of the people.
Well, David, congratulations on this National Geographic issue, and thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry. Great to talk with you.
David Quammen wrote the text for the special May issue of National Geographic devoted to Yellowstone and the battle for the American West. He spoke with Terry last Monday. Fresh Air Weekend is produced by John Sheehan. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our technical director and engineer is Audrey Bentham. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Roberta Shurrock, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, Heidi Simon, Teresa Madden, and Thea Challoner. Molly C.V. Nesper is our associate producer of online media. For Terry Gross, I'm David Biancooley.